My name's Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of a loving God in the program, the people, and principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome anybody who's reasonably new. I'm glad you're here. If you've got here kind of like I got here, I'm probably more glad you're here than you are. Finding myself in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't feel like the high point of my life. But I tell you something, square business, if you stay here and you find half of what I find here, you've walked into the best deal you ever walk into your whole life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've come to love the people in it and the power I've found here. I also, I'm a member of Al-Anon. Working with a lot of newcomers and sponsoring people has driven me as a whimpering newcomer about 10 years ago into Al-Anon. Are there any members of Al-Anon here? Don't be ashamed. Okay. Do you know why so many alcoholics end up marrying Al-Anons? They finally find someone who thinks about them as much as they do. That's not a joke, that's the truth. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm everything that it says in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's a line in there that says that we were bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And I believe that I was an alcoholic before I ever took the first drink. I was just waiting. There was, as far back as I can remember, there was always something that wasn't quite right about me, a lingering uneasiness, an emptiness and a sense of urgency that I could never quite put into words. There was never anybody in my family, my neighborhood, in school, that looked the way I felt. There's no one that seemed to have the awkwardness around people that I always felt. And don't get me wrong, that's not that I didn't appear, looking back, I know that I appeared to fit, but I never felt like it. I always felt like I was coming from behind, like that no matter what other people had to do to fit, I had to do more, and it was never enough, and it was never enough because I was never enough. You know, in grade school, I had to get A's just to feel equal to the kids that got C's. And in later years, when it was more hip to be a juvenile delinquent, I had to swear more and fight more and steal more and do all that stuff more just to be equal. And it never really works. Because when you walk around with the emptiness of alcoholism that I had, it's impossible to fix an inside disease with outside stuff. It's just impossible. But you don't know that if you're like I am. You know, Angie said some things last night that really helped me, and I really enjoyed her talk. I've come to believe that alcoholism is a love disorder. I've gone through life believing that if the right people loved me, if enough people loved me, if enough people accepted me, that I would feel lovable, that I would feel acceptable. And that made a lot of sense to me. The problem with that is if you have this disease and you have the inside emptiness of alcoholism, we at times find ourselves in the position where the right people love us and a lot of people care about us. And it doesn't help. It doesn't take away that thing in there. And after several years of sobriety, I stumbled into the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was, in loving you, the hole goes away. It doesn't go away in you loving me. And the only time I've ever felt like I was whole and complete and like I was doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing with a purpose and usefulness is when I'm working with newcomers. Is when I'm a channel and I'm not taken. And this is a vacuum-powered disease. You know, for me, it was always trying to fill up this hole, trying to fill up the emptiness. And it's kind of like trying to fill up the sky by shoveling dirt into it. You know, the harder you work, the dirtier you get, and you don't get nowhere, right? You know, I started drinking when I was about 12 years old. And I started like a lot of us started, peer pressure. I just desperately wanted to fit with the guys I was hanging around with. And I thought that if I do what they do and I act like they act, maybe I would feel like they look. And these were the guys, they were a little older than I was, and they were the juvenile delinquents. They had the slick back hair and the tight pants and carried the switchblades and kind of like kids today. And, you know, if you're like I am, nothing works. You know, I'm trying it all. I'm shoplifting, I'm doing all that stuff, and I'm still coming from behind. I'm still not, I still don't feel like they look. And one day we pulled a little burglary and we stole some liquor, and we were passing around this bottle of Seagram 7, and I have no idea what happened to any of those other kids when they took that drink, but I remember real clearly what happened to me. And here I am coming from behind with that emptiness that I've always felt, and I don't fit, and I'm less than, and I'm putting up the front, hoping that I would, you know, feel like they look and all that other stuff. And I took a hit off this bottle of Seagram 7, and it got down inside of me. And for the first time in my life, I found the thing I'd hungered for. I found a sense of wholeness, and I felt like they looked. And after a couple more hits, it started becoming real clear to me how superior I was to these guys. And then that alcoholic feeling of brotherly love kind of comes in, you know, and you realize that even though you're better than them, I mean, I'm a big guy, I can hang around with guys like this. And then I went from that into throwing up into a blackout, being taken home, dumped on the front yard of my parents' house in the middle of the afternoon, screaming obscenities at the top of my lungs to endear myself to the neighbors. And I come to shortly after that, and my parents are patiently waiting to tell me what I've done. And I don't believe it, because I don't remember it. And it was a horror to find out I did all these things and said all these things I can't remember saying or doing. And you would think that anybody with any degree of mental health would say to themselves, I will never do that again. Well, I couldn't wait to drink again. I don't care what the price is. I found the thing that I hungered for all my life. I found the thing that gave me what I wanted so desperately, and that was a sense of wholeness, a feeling like I fit. And I didn't care what the price is. And I'll tell you something that may shock some of you. If I could get that effect from alcohol today, I would drink alcohol today. I would continue to be willing to live on Skid Row and Panhandle. I would continue to be willing to go in and out of county jails. I would continue to be willing to sell my soul on those streets. If I could get the effects from alcohol that I got as a young teenager. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not because of the places I ended up and the things I did. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason only. Alcohol stopped being an effective treatment for the dis-ease of alcoholism. And the cruelest blow of all was not that I was ending up in county jails and in missions and Salvation Armies. It was not that I drank away my family, every relationship, and every good opportunity God had ever put in my path, is that my lover had left me. And there was no more relief in alcoholism, or in alcohol. But if you're a real alcoholic and you're like I am absolutely incapable of living dry for any sustained period of time with untreated alcoholism. I can't do it. There comes a point where I have no mental defense against my own emptiness. And I will drink again no matter what, no matter what. I believe that alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. And, you know, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think I was even old enough to drink. It was 1971. And it was a prerequisite of an institution that I would have been put into. And I got to AA, and by the time I went to my first meeting and I was in this first institution, things were pretty bad in my life, right? But you know, they tell you, and you don't believe it, they say alcoholism is a progressive disease. And you think to yourself, well, yeah, but geez, it can't get any worse than this. And you know what happens? It gets worse, right? And it keeps getting worse. It gets so bad that by the end, for me, it's like if I could just feel better, I think I'd kill myself, right? And I would, you know, being exposed to you at the beginning was, you had nothing I wanted. You were them, right? There was nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous that looked like I would have drank with you. There's nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous that I would care to associate with. Most of you guys looked like, to me, like you might have had a drink too many on the golf course, said something embarrassing to your boss, and came to Alcoholics Anonymous for better business connections. <All right>? And I didn't fit here. You guys talked about stupid stuff. You talked about God, and people would get up to the podium and, I just love everybody, you know, and give me a break. Where do you live and when aren't you going to be home, you know? But you know, you keep drinking, things get real simple. And in the years from 71 to 78, I was in and out of the program, and that's a tough way to go. And every time I would get sober and go back out again, a little bit more of me was stripped away. Chuck C. used to say that you get to a place where there's nothing left between you and you. And I found myself in 1978 at that place. Prior to my last drunk, I was living in a Skid Row mission on the north side of Pittsburgh, and I was there because it was winter time. And I was there also because I'd been sentenced there by the courts to do a year in some kind of treatment center as an alternative to prison. And I had no place, I was indigent, I had no place to live, I had nothing to do, I had no job skills, I'm in this place. And the guy who ran the place was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was one of the first people that ever carried the message to me, even though I hated him and everything he said. And he used to tell me things like, I would go to him and he'd ask me how I was doing. I'd say, I'm doing great. I've learned my lesson. I'm never going to drink again. Just like in A Vision for You, work better, feel better, having a better time, you know? And he'd just look at me with that look that people in Alcoholics Anonymous always give you. You know, and you want to look down and see if you messed yourself or something, you know? It's a funny kind of smile. You know something's really funny here. You don't know what it is, but they're looking at you, right? And he'd give me that look, and he always was on my back about getting a sponsor, and I knew he just wanted another notch on his big book. He wanted me to ask him, right? And I'd die rather than ask that SOB to be my sponsor. And one night, he made us go to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a big meeting. There must have been 150 people there, and I went in and found my seat in the back of this room in the inventory section where I always liked to sit so I could figure out properly what was wrong with everyone. And I was the kind of guy that did that. You know, I did that, I think, as a newcomer, I couldn't do anything else because when I'm scared and I feel like I don't fit, my mind desperately grabs and works overtime to try to find something wrong with everybody else, hoping that if I find enough wrong with you, that I'll be even. But that doesn't work, because it starts out, I'm in bad shape and you're okay, and then it ends up, we're both in bad shape. You know, it doesn't help at all. It increases the separation rather than the opposite. But I'm sitting in the back of the room in this inventory section, and the guy gets up to the podium and he's celebrating 10 years of sobriety. And in all my years of being in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never saw anybody in AA that looked like this guy. I saw a lot of guys in the institutions I was in that looked like this guy. This guy had long hair and a beard. And I had real long hair and a beard. I was kind of held over from the 60s, right? And I would sit, you know, most of the time I would sit in meetings and I don't feel like I fit there. I got checked shirt and checked pants on that they gave me in the Sally or wherever I'm at, and the checks don't match, you know, and I didn't know that'd be a fashion statement someday. And I'd sit there and I'd look around, I don't fit. But this guy looked like somebody I might have drank with, you know, because just because of the way he looked. And he was celebrating 10 years of sobriety, and nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous looked like this guy back there. Everybody wore three-piece suits, drove Cadillacs, and had their wife under arm. At least it appeared that way to me. And I listened to this guy, and he talked about things I suppose they were said before, I just never heard them. He talked about drinking until he passed out and going to the bathroom on himself and how embarrassed he'd be. He talked about that feeling, that paranoia, that feeling like everybody was looking at him. He talked about the shame and the guilt that he carried around and all the failures in his life and the sense of worthlessness that he felt. And he said a lot of things that hit home with me. And I'm living in this place and there's pressure on me to get a sponsor, so I thought to myself, maybe I could talk to this guy. And I went up to him after the meeting and I said, I went to ask him to be my sponsor and I choked up, I couldn't ask him. I guess looking back now that I was afraid that he was gonna look at me and feel about me the way I did. I was afraid he was gonna look at me and say, what? Me sponsor someone like you? Right? And I was afraid of that rejection. So I walked up to him and I shook hands with him and I said, how'd you stay sober 10 years? He looked me right in the eye and said, I didn't drink. Now, up until that moment, I kind of liked that guy. But when he said that, it was like a balloon inside of me collapsed. And I just turned around and walked away, and I never did ask him. And he touched something inside of me that I didn't want to look at. The real reason I didn't fit in Alcoholics Anonymous, if there's anybody here that's new, this is real important. I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I really wouldn't feel like I fit because I had a secret. And the secret was that I didn't have what it takes to not drink alcohol. And I look around in Alcoholics Anonymous and everybody here would stop drinking and they seem to be reasonably happy. And it's not that I couldn't stop drinking, I could stop drinking. But every time I put down the bottle, it felt like I was doing time. And if you've ever sat in a county jail waiting to get out, you know what I mean. And every time I'd stop drinking, the emptiness would become overwhelming. And the feeling like I don't fit would come back, and all the shame and things I've done to my family and all the people that ever loved me. And I would sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would watch you enjoy not drinking. And it was the thing that held me the most apart from you. And if you're new, it never occurred to me that you were like me. It never occurred to me that you didn't have what it takes to not drink either. I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I did what all self-centered people do. I compare my insides to your outsides and I come up a loser. And I felt less than, I felt like I don't have what it takes to stay here. You know, there's a saying, you hear it all the time, we come in here, we're egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. And it's not so much that I'm a piece of whale shit, I'm a special piece of whale shit. I'm a cut above everybody. You know, it's like I'm grade A, right? I'm a little different, I'm a unique scumbag, right? And, you know, one of the things that almost killed me was my lack of humility. And, you know, I thought humility was when you think poorly of yourself, we think less of yourself. And what I've discovered, it's when you think of yourself less. You know, my lack of humility almost killed me because I didn't think I was worth I was worth sobriety. You know, I would hear people in treatment centers say, well, you got to do this for yourself. Why? I'd do it for you. I valued you more than I did me. I do a lot of volunteer work at the Salvation Army, and I trick these people. I tell them, I pair them up. I say, it doesn't matter if you go to meetings, but you have to take this one. And they'll, oh, I can do that. I'll see that this guy gets to meetings. And the other one said, now you've got to see that this guy gets, oh, I'll do that. And they go to meetings like crazy. They go like, they'll go every day. They'll go 3-4 times a day. You tell them to go for themselves, and it's like, yeah, get around to it, you know. That almost killed me. You know, I knew for a long time that I was an alcoholic, but I didn't really understand this disease. You know, one of the greatest things that has been given to Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, is the doctor's opinion in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dr. Silkworth in there talks about both phases of the disease. He talks about the phenomenon of craving, what happens to the real alcoholic once he takes a drink, and that this phenomenon of craving differentiates me from every other wacko out in the world. It's why I come to AA instead of any other program. And he also talks about the other part of the disease, the obsession of the mind. What happens to guys like me once they stop drinking alcohol? And he makes a statement in there that I've never heard it put better. He says that when we are dry, we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience the ease and comfort we'd once found by taking a few drinks. You know, I've heard many times that this disease called is a disease of chronic malcontent. And I wondered, why in my first few years of sobriety, no matter what gifts God would give me, in a real short period of time, they seemed like there was nothing to them anymore. Like I would be let down. I got my first new car when I'm several years sober, and it's like it was wonderful for about 3 weeks, and then all I got's the payments. The first time I ever got a job that paid $200 a week, I was ecstatic. Until 3 weeks later, you know, it wasn't enough. Right? And I wondered, what's this letdown come from? And I think Silkworth talks about it. I think subconsciously, if you're a real alcoholic and you've once found the magic from alcohol, that I am destined to have a tendency to compare whatever richness life has and how it feels to have that new car, that relationship, that kind of self, whatever's going on, to how it once felt years ago when I took 4 or 5 shots of whiskey. And when I do that subconsciously, everything in life comes up just short. Right? Because if you're a real alcoholic, we were given a great gift in alcohol. And the great gift was that we had a magic in a bottle that would actually change the face of the universe. I remember working one time at a job that I couldn't stand. And this was years before I even thought I had a problem. I wasn't even really that bad in those days. And I worked at that job. I hated the job. I hated the people I worked with. I hated everything about it. I couldn't stand it. I was on a time clock. The whistle would blow, and I would rush out of there, and by the time I would leave there, I'm so there now. I'm going to go to the hospital.
Is a mountain. It seems to move and not around it. Water's sticking up ahead, just beyond moving on it. Yeah, this moves a little quite the hell. Yeah, this flushing out. Got my arms been on the door. Yeah.
I just said, okay. And I just go to these meetings and until I have to drink again. Because I didn't think I'd stay sober. I never did before. And one day I was about 30 days sober and I'm dry just long enough to start to think clearly. Bad place. And I'm in a meeting and I'm going crazy. My head's doing a number on me. It's cranking me up good. It's telling me, look, you got warrants out for your arrest from back east. You're going to probably go to prison. You don't have a place to live. You don't have a job. You don't have job skills. You don't know anybody in this town. You're 2,000 miles away from home. What makes you think you're going to stay sober? Who are you trying to kid? You might as well just drink. What's the big deal here? You know, on and on. It's just grinding at me. And I got real scared, and I went up to a meeting, up to a guy after a meeting, and that was an old timer, and I started telling him all this stuff. And he listened very patiently to me whining and rambling on and on and on. And then he said, well, first of all, I think that none of that stuff is any of your business. Novel idea. He said, you have one thing and one thing only to concern yourself with, and that's recovery from the disease of alcoholism in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did something that is rarely done in AA. He gave me a guarantee. And I have since given the same guarantee to newcomers. He told me that, he says, I promise you that if you put as much time and effort into recovery from alcoholism in the program and fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous as you used to put into trying to stay loaded and run the universe, I promise you that all these unresolved areas of your life will take care of themselves in spite of you. I just said, okay. I said, whatever. I don't have an idea that works. I don't have a better thought in my head. I don't know how to undo any of that stuff. I don't know how to fix it. I'll just make AA the center of my life. And I'll just do everything you people tell me to do. And I got a sponsor, and I started doing all the actions of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the people in AA encouraged me to form four habits. And these four habits have saved my life. And the first, and they told me that if I were to do these things, fit these four things into my life on a regular or daily basis, that I would survive my disease long enough to begin to recover in the steps. And the first habit was the meeting habit, that I go to a meeting every day. And if I can't get to one someday, I'll catch two some other day. And I've been doing that for over 12 years. And they told me, they said, if anybody hears from a treatment center, they told me meetings at the treatment center or a hospital that you were in don't count. And they said it doesn't count unless you get there 10 minutes early and talk to somebody and stay at least 10 minutes late and talk to somebody. The second habit was the God habit, that I get down on my knees at least twice a day and talk intimately to God about what's going on inside of me and my own powerlessness and the help that I need for this day, and that I thank him at the end of the day. The third habit was the transparency habit, that I get transparent with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous every day and tell them what's going on inside of me with my feelings and my thinking and what's going on outside of me with my finances and relationships and job and etc. And the last habit was a service habit, that I do something for another person every day. That I try, whether it's working with a newcomer or being a secretary of a meeting, that I just say yes to whatever God puts in my path to do. That I take the attitude of subservience, that I am here to do whatever he puts in front of me. Any chance that I can be helpful, it's my job to do that. And I've been trying, and I tell you something, I don't do a perfect job of those four things, but I've been trying to do those things for over 12 years. And I believe thoroughly that if I wouldn't have gotten those habits in my life, I would have not survived my disease long enough to get into a fourth step the way it's outlined in the book and to make the amends and to develop a relationship with God. I didn't believe in God. I just was so beaten up when they said, just pray. Okay. I kind of had the attitude, if there's a God, I'm probably in a lot of trouble. Right? See, I was raised Catholic, which is a whole separate recovery story. And I don't say that to offend anybody that's Catholic. You got to understand that what I heard in Catholic school and what was actually said may not be the same thing, because there's people I went to school with that are still Catholic, right? And if they heard what I heard, I don't think they'd still be Catholic. But I got told, you know, I had this idea about God that was like, he had these tremendous lists of things that you got to do, and these lists of things that you can't do, and if you don't know what's on the list and you do something you're not supposed to do, it doesn't matter, you're screwed. And you, even if you don't do it, if you just think about doing it, it's the same thing. The nuns used to say, you got to be pure of thought, word, and deed. And the minute they'd say the word pure, it's like X-rated movies that start going through my mind, right? And I'm just a kid, I don't want to think that. And I'd say, oh, don't think that, you know. I remember we used to have, one time of the year, they'd take us in a group, right? And we have to go to confession. It's supposed to be like a fifth step, right? And you go in there and you get a clean slate. And this is on a Friday afternoon. And then we'd all go as a group Sunday morning to communion. And you can't take communion if you got anything going on, right? Now, every Friday afternoon, a whole bunch of us would go in there to these boxes and we'd unload all this crap, right? Now, I got to not think anything until Sunday morning, right? I wouldn't even get out of the goddamn box and I'm thinking stuff, right? And I would go to Sunday morning, I'd go to church, and I'd be sitting there and I'm looking around. And you know something? I could tell by looking at these kids that nobody else has thought anything since Friday. And they all just get up there and take that communion, and I go up right with them, because I'm not going to tell them, right? And I go up there, and I know I'm screwed, right? And then, you know, I found, when I was an adolescent, I found the wonderful world of masturbation, and there was a meter in heaven going, counting up millions of years, right, in purgatory, and I didn't even get to do something yet. I'm just practicing, right? So, now, this is my perception of God, so you can understand why I'm not too happy about the idea that my sobriety relies upon God, right? But you know, if you're a real alcoholic and you drink long enough, you get to a point where you're in so much pain and so much desperation and hopelessness that it just doesn't matter. You know, it's like God, even if there is a punishing God that they told you about as a kid, what's he going to do that's any worse than this? You know, what's he going to do that's any worse than this? There's a song that came out years ago called Bobby McGee, and in that song's the line says, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nothing left to lose. Didn't matter if there was a God, didn't matter, nothing. I don't have any place to go. I have nothing else I can do. I'm done. My sponsor and my home group are really into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was very fortunate to have fallen into the hands of people who believed in nothing except the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the actions of sober members of AA. And they encouraged me to take the actions of sober members of AA and to get into the steps as precisely outlined in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't say that to make anybody uncomfortable. If you've done a four-step any other way, there's every untreated Al-Anon alcoholism counselor has written a four-step guide, right? And some of them are bizarre. I read one, it was 180 questions, and, you know, did you ever sleep with a German shepherd? And what was the German shepherd Republican, you know? And it's just, you know, just... I believe in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? That's where I've gotten my recovery. And one of the things that I was in, you know, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous are more important, they're so powerful that if you're new, it doesn't matter what you think and it doesn't matter what you feel. If you take the actions of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to get the results. You know, there were times when I was in and out that if you would have sat me down and you would have asked me if I was done, and you would have put me on a polygraph, and you would have said, are you willing to go to any lengths to not drink? I bet you I would have said, yeah, I'm willing to go to any lengths. And I bet you the polygraph would have said I was telling the truth. But when I got out of that mission or treatment center or county jail, I didn't act like it. And there were times when I felt so enthusiastic about not drinking and about turning my life around and everything, that I felt it in my heart, and yet I didn't take the actions. So I've come to the conclusion that recovery is not in the mind, and it's not in the heart, it's in the feet. All right? I guess that's why in the big book it says we don't get sober until we've admitted complete defeat. Oh, that was bad. I don't know where that came from, but it ought to go back there. And it, you know, it doesn't matter. I go to a lot of hospital and institution meetings. That's where I feel the most useful. I love these kind of weekends. I really do. But I feel that's the spot that God has given me to be useful. And I go to several meetings a week in those places. And I work with a lot of newcomers, and I do it not because I'm an altruistic type of guy. I do it because it's a substantial part of my own recovery. God works through those people to give me what I need. And the thing I try to encourage him to do is that it doesn't matter if you feel like going to meetings. It doesn't matter if you think there's a God. It doesn't matter any of that stuff. Just do it. Just do it. And if you take the actions long enough, eventually it turns around inside and you wake up one day and you realize that you feel it. And you realize that you know it's so. See, my relationship with God was real. My second step was real slow in coming. It was a long process coming to believe. And I prayed a long time, and I was sober quite a long time before I really where I live knew that there was a God that loved me and felt that he was a active part of my life. I guess for a long time I was just hoping that there was, maybe, or I was hope I was doing I wanted what you guys had, and I was just doing what you guys do. But what had happened to me is God convinced me. See, emotionally, I'm from Missouri. You got to show me, right? And what happened is through the first couple years of my sobriety, miracles would happen in my life. And I don't mean one or two. I mean hundreds. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times I would have a problem, and I would go to a meeting, and there'd be some stranger there I have never seen that has the answer to my problem. And that didn't happen once. That happened hundreds of times. And how just the perfect thing that I needed would just come into my life. And I've come to believe that God loves me, not through anything I've read or anything that anybody's told me, but by observing the effects that he has had in my life and in yours. You know, I heard a story years ago. It's about over in London. Back in the 1800s, all the streets were lit by gas lamps. And every night at sundown, there would be a guy who would walk through the city of London with a torch, and he'd light all those lamps, and he was called a lamplighter. And you could go up to the Tower of London and look out over the city of London, and you could never see where the lamplighter was, but you could see where he's been. And I know God loves me. And I know he is a substantial part of my life because I've seen where he's been in my life. I can't always feel his presence in me, but I can almost always feel it in you. It never fails that no matter what happens in my life, if I ask God for help and take myself to you openly with my problems, that I get whatever I need, not only to get through the situation, but to get through it more than what I was going into it. You know, if you stay sober a number of years, things happen to you. And I've gone through a lot of things in sobriety, some that were all growing experiences. I came off Skid Row, and I had a problem with employment. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I grew up, and I had no skills, I had nothing. And when I was about a year sober, I was asking God a lot for some kind of direction. There's a line in the 12x12 in step 11 that says that we get direction and guidance in our life just to the extent that we don't demand it in our time and on our terms. And there was a guy in my home group that used to say, if you ask God for guidance and direction, you got to have an open mind. And don't let your head talk you out of whatever's put in front of you. And a guy came up to me and offered me a job for $3 an hour working in a liquor store. Right? And my head went crazy with that. It's like, how you can't do that. You'll drink. You blah, 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 blah. You can't live on $3 an hour. You don't know how to run a register. You never drank anything except Wild Irish Rose. How do you know anything about the product? On and on and on. But the words of this guy stuck out in my head. And I'd been praying for guidance, and there it was, man. It was right. I didn't go after it. I didn't manufacture it. I didn't nothing. It was right there in front of me. And I said, okay, I'll take that job. And I started working at that job, and I started noticing something about me is that I have a hard time fitting with normies. And when I get real scared, I get real isolated and I get on the muscle. And I don't know how not to do that. I don't know how not to have a good attitude. I don't know how to have a good attitude. Because when I'm frightened, my emotions are stronger than my intentions. And I would go to work and sometimes I just feel like the customers were bothering me and I was underpaid and I wasn't appreciated. I told him that everything that was going on, and he just told me, he says, you got to change your attitude. And it's like, okay, I know that, but I don't know how to do it. And I was real involved in those years in general service. And I was involved on a panel at one of the, we have a thing on the West Coast, it's called PRASA, it's a Pacific Region Area Alcoholics Anonymous Service Assembly, and it's a real service-oriented thing, and I was involved in that, and I The guy who spoke Saturday night there was a guy who died several years ago, Chuck Chamberlain. And I heard Chuck say some things that about employment that really got my attention. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I told him, I only talked to him for about a minute and a half, and I told him about how I felt on the job. And he told me, he said, "You got it all wrong." He said, "You got to go to work for one reason and one reason only, and that's to be of service to the people that are there. If you go for any other reason than that, you're missing the whole deal." So I went back to Las Vegas, and I started asking God every day, "Please, God, help me to be of service in there. Help me to be helpful to the people that are there." And I would do it, and some days I'd be in there, and 10 minutes later, they're bothering me again, you know, and I just have to, "God, please help." And I'd work on it, work on it, and it started becoming easier. And the funniest thing started happening. I started enjoying going to work, and I started feeling something that I never felt except in my home group. I never felt out in the world. And I've come to believe it's more important than happiness. I started feeling useful. And from the usefulness, I had developed a sense of wholeness there. And I started loving going to work. And people would ask for me, and they would come in, and I would sell them these rare wines that I don't know anything about, you know, and I just show them in the book, "Well, it says this, you know." And in no time at all, I was the manager of that place. And which led, there was a guy that I knew who had a liquor store that he was kind of burnt out, and he wanted out, and he tried to sell it, and the deal fell through, and they weren't doing real good financially. And I went to him one day, and I, through the encouragement of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, "I'd like to own your liquor store, but I don't have any money." And I was waiting for him to laugh. And he said, "Maybe we can work something out. Maybe if you can produce this much profit, for every year you can produce this much profit, I'll let half of that profit go towards your buying a share of the business. And if you can do such and such, this level for 5 years, we'll be even, and then you can buy me out." And I went to work with the attitude that you guys had taught me and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sometimes can't believe what has happened. We have a chain of stores now. We make a lot of money. And I don't want to make, it's not my intention to make a lot of money. All I wanted to do was, work was such a big part of my day, I just wanted to feel good there, that's all. Success is a scary thing. I can live with failure pretty easy. But you give me a lot, you give an alcoholic money and watch him act funny. And I've gone through some major attitude adjustments as a result of some financial success. And I realized that God was very slowly crafting me into the kind of person that can accept some things in his life that are good. See, I can accept the bad things. Because somewhere I still had that low self-esteem. I feel like that's what I deserve. Now, I'm sober over 12 years, and my self-esteem, I get glimpses of it sometimes, is still not real good. But you know, it doesn't make any difference, because if I take the actions of someone who is God's child, I get the results. No matter how poorly I feel about myself. You know, I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous to a gal about 8 years ago. No, we met about 8 years ago. We got married about seven years ago. And we were married 4.5 years. And I have a daughter who is 3.5 years old that I love very much. After we'd been married a few years, I started noticing that there was a distance in our marriage, and I didn't really know what to do about it. And I was so, at this point in time, I was really involved in work, and I was on a lot of committees in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I was very busy, and I really didn't pay that much attention to it. And one day, there was a guy I was hanging around with that I sponsored that we'd become real close friends. And I would talk, rather than talk to my sponsor about it, I talked to him because he knew her real well, and we were all kind of, and him and I became real close.
And one day my ex-wife came to me and she said she wanted out. And we'd tried some marriage counseling that didn't seem to do anything. And she wanted out of the marriage, and I said, okay, and I was in a lot of pain. I didn't really understand, you know, I didn't understand why, because I really believed that we could have made it. At that point, I thought, well, maybe we could make this work. I was still hanging on. And we got legally divorced in court on a Thursday, and the next Friday, and the following day on Friday, she moved in with my best friend and my daughter all moved in together. And they'd been having an affair for a year behind my back. The guy I was talking to, Sharon, with. And I was devastated. I don't know if I wanted what it was like on a real good day when I had a lot of mental health, I wanted to kill him, and on a bad mental health day, I wanted to kill me. And I thought, you know something, I never thought about drinking. But I thought about suicide a lot. And I hurt a lot. And you know, what scared me the most, and there was a couple things going on. One of them was I'd never, at that time I was sober probably 10 years, I guess, or so. And in those 10 years, I had never encountered anything. I went through a lot of pain. I buried my dad. People that I sponsored committed suicide. I went through a lot of stuff, but it was all short term. You know, a month later, you feel okay about it, but this was relentless. And the resentment, you know, and I would hear things, and people in AA tell me it's my ego. I said, yeah, I know that, but Jesus doesn't take the pain away. You know, and I would go to meetings, and I'd cry and share about it, and I would work with newcomers, and I don't know why I'm working with them. It's like, you don't want what I got, you know? I was so self-obsessed. It's like you could have come up to me and said, I'm dying of cancer, and did you see what my wife did? I was self-absorbed. But I kept going to, I went to probably one or two meetings every day, and I went to a lot of hospitals, and the guys that I sponsored, some of them sat with me round the clock. Some of them would take off work to come and see how I was doing. And I would try to reach down inside myself at times and grab onto something to hold on to, and there wasn't anything there. But I would grab onto you, and you would reach down inside yourself, and there was something there. And I could hang on to you. And I think the real reason that I, even though I thought a lot about suicide, I think the real reason I didn't kill myself is that I couldn't stand the thought of disappointing you. I couldn't stand the thought of being a bad example of Alcoholics Anonymous after all you've given me. I couldn't stand the fact of being just another statistic and letting you down. I didn't care for me. If it was up to me, I think I just wanted out of the pain. I didn't care. But I couldn't do that to you. And, you know, maybe that's a stupid reason to stay sober and not commit suicide, but it's what got me through it. And your love. And God put people in my life. He put newcomers that were going through divorces. It was like all of a sudden I became a magnet for broken marriages. It was like for three goddamn states they were coming. I don't know where they're coming from. And it's like, why are you talking to me? I'm going through the same thing, you know? And once again, I get it. You know, I get what I need, right? And I was real afraid that I lost my daughter. When I saw her move in with them, it broke my heart because I love my daughter very much. And about 2 weeks ago, I took her to Disneyland for her first trip. And when she got, I went and got her, and she gives me this big hug, and she says, Daddy, I miss you so bad. And we have a better relationship today than I think we've ever had. And I almost killed myself and missed the whole thing. And, you know, my, through a lot, God's put a lot of people in my life and a lot of things. And I've prayed for my ex-wife and her boyfriend, I bet you 20,000 times. I bet you. And I've written 4 steps on it. But things take time. And just in the last few months, God has put some people in my life at times when I was ready to hear some things. You know, just lately I've been feeling like I miss them. And I not too long ago I celebrated my 12th birthday and I invited them to my home group had this big party. I think they were just wanted to celebrate that I hadn't committed suicide. It was like he's back. And I invited them and I really wanted them to be there. And I guess as a friend of a guy was put in my path and he said something and I think it's true. I think it's the God in me has gotten tired of not loving them. And you know, they were two of the most important people in my life at one time. And I miss that. And I miss them. And the great miracle is that I've somehow, I didn't do it, that I just showed up, and somehow I've come to forgive them. And it's hard. I didn't think I would do it. Angie, I spent some time a year and a half ago with Angie's sponsor, and I'm whining about this, and she says, well, what you cannot cure, you must endure. And do you have a razor blade? Thanks, Mary, I needed that. You want to kick me while I'm... And I've gotten, and that, you know, that really helped me. I got to the point where I had to get to a point where I was willing to accept the pain and willing to accept the whole deal and just say, okay, God, if this is it, if I got to have this goddamn resentment for the rest of my life, if they got to be a part of my thinking every day forever, just please don't let me drink and let me keep showing up here and doing what I'm doing. And I'll bear it if that's what it is. And I think part of that was when things started to turn around inside of me. You know, if you're new, Alcoholics Anonymous has good news and it has bad news. The good news is that what we have here is a real substantial treatment for the dis-ease and separation of alcoholism. But the bad news is that it doesn't work as fast as 5 shots of Jack Daniels. Right. And I don't know about anybody else, but I have come through life with a sense of urgency. Right? You want to see me have to work some steps, put me in DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicles line one day. Right? And I'll remember what turning it over is over again. But if you're new and you're got here like I am, we don't have any other place to go. Man, I was a child of the 60s. I tried everything. I tried Gestalt therapy. I tried rational emotive therapy. I tried every treatment center there was in the world. I tried transcendental meditation. I've been everything from Ram Dass to Rum Dum. And I never found anything that worked for alcoholism until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But yet, I couldn't get here and take the actions that you guys suggested until all of me was beaten out of me. I was so full of myself, there was no room for anything new. And I won't paint you a picture that this is a rose garden because growing up is tough. Becoming the kind of person that can stay sober under all conditions is tough. But God has always and will always give me exactly what I need to get through it. And like my divorce and some of the things that have happened to me are blessings. And alcoholism is a blessing. A blessing is anything that will kick you, shove you, push you, or drag you screaming into being something more than what you were. And I don't think you can grow up spiritually or emotionally by avoiding pain. And it's like it says in the big book, we don't manufacture misery. We don't, you know, I believe God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. I believe that. I believe that there's only one person on the face of the earth that's ever stood between me and all the richness and happiness and abundance God has ever given any of his kids, and it has been me. It has been me. And if I come to you and I bring me to you, God will work through you to keep me from hurting me. You know, the great miracle, the beginning of recovery for a lot of us starts with the third step. And it wasn't that I turned my will and my life over the care of God. I didn't really have a God in my understanding. Kind of turned it over to you. But the miracle happened, I was just willing to get it out of the hands of an idiot. Right? You know, this is a wonderful journey. And there's no destination here. It's the trip. We were talking at dinner the other night. You know, sometimes I get a case of the when I's, right? I'll be happy when I, right? I'll be this when I. Hey, man, it's now. This is it. This is it. Life's in session. This is it. I have to somewhere reach the mechanical toys arrive to boast and swagger, and by break their mainsprings and pass away. And he knew that they were only toys and would never turn into anything else. For nursery magic is very strange and wonderful, and only those playthings that are old and wise and experienced like the skin horse understand all about it. "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender, before Nana came to tidy the room. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and stick out like a handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up?" he asked, "or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily, or who have sharp edges, or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out, and you get loose joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to those who don't understand." I love you all. Thank you.